Hello and welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is Conscious Leadership, Call for a New Paradigm with John Renish. So I would like to let you know that there are a number of other great programs coming up. We have them online and in our club magazine. Please pick one up on your way out. I want to tell you a little bit about John Renish before I introduce him. John Renish is an advisor, mentor, futurist, and writer on matters of social and organizational change with 4 decades of experience as a business owner and entrepreneur. He left his CEO position in the real estate investment industry in the mid-80s and embarked upon a new path. John is now a global futurist, humanitarian, writer, and keynote speaker on topics that integrate the subjects of business, human consciousness, and possible scenarios for the future of humanity. Please welcome John Renish.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Well, first of all, it's a pleasure to be here and to see a room that's pretty full. So thank you for that, too. First thing I thought I'd do is give you a little bit of background. Some of you are friends of mine, so you know a lot about this. So just don't doze off, or if you do doze off, don't snore. And those that you don't know me, a little background for context. The first half of my life, I was an entrepreneur, a business guy. Never did get a degree in college. I forsake that I can't even say proper English. I forsook. But anyway, I was in business. I started my first business when I was 18. I had a lot of fun doing a lot of fun businesses. And if it looked like fun and it was a business that you could make some money at, I was doing it. And as soon as I got successful at it, I got bored and went on to something else. But that was my background, business. Have an idea, convert it to something that was commercial, and pitch it and sell it and try to make a lot of money and have a good time. And then I went through a midlife crisis. Does anybody know what a midlife crisis is like? I mean, I'm looking at men mainly. I know women know about it. Yeah. And at 37, 38 years old, I really thought I had done it all. I know that seems preposterous, but that's the malaise. And so I went through this dark night of the soul, discovered the human potential movement, realized that we were not necessarily on a glide path from our conditioning or our childhood, that we could change the way our lives went. And as a result of that, got very interested in things like potential of organizations and potential of groups of people, not just my own potential. So around that time, I decided to get financially independent, started a real estate company with that goal in mind, and then started a foundation that was going to do some great work in the world, save the planet kind of thing. And in my human potentialness, I was filled with arrogance, a lot of ego, and I thought I could do anything because I knew the secret. Oh, boy. Anyway, I got to be a little bit on the crude side. I got my butt handed to me and came to a realization that maybe I could do a business that actually did good rather than, after being humbled, by the way. I won't go into all the details of the humbling. But the point is that I became a futurist, and I'm a very odd character for most futurists. Most futurists make their living at doing either predictions, projecting trends, etc., or a thing called scenario planning, which is still a relatively new art, where companies hire people to come in and project various scenarios of what's likely to happen, and then they can decide which ones to prepare for, maybe prepare for them all. Well, when I joined the World Future Society and started hanging out at their conferences and all that, I discovered that most of them weren't my kind of futurist. My kind of futurist was, what kind of future do we want, and how can we create that? There's a saying by Peter Drucker that's often been quoted attributed to other people, called, the best way to predict the future is to create it. But most futurists don't, they know that phrase, they know that quote, but they still are looking at existing trends and saying, well, if this continues to here, it's going to be this way. So we look at all the global crises we have in the world, it looks pretty grim. So my kind of futurism is, let's create the kind of future that we want, and not be bound by the existing trends. Now, that may be a little bold, but it's a way of putting a vision out there. Anybody in sports or even starting businesses know that you put the vision out there, and then you more or less throw a hook out to that vision and let it pull you to it rather than jumping off the past. It's a much more enlightened way of creating a different kind of reality. So I became a futurist, a maverick futurist of sorts. I'd go to these conferences, there'd be 2,000 or 3,000 futurists there, and there might be 5 or 6 people that I was really interested in talking to. And so in the world of futurism right now, I'd say that I probably know personally most of the people that share my idea of creating a better future. It's a pretty small group compared to the numbers of people that call themselves futurists and make a living at it. Most are academics. A lot of them are academics and work for the government. Few of them have private consulting firms, not many. But there aren't many that have business backgrounds. So I like to think that I bring pragmatics into future. So I can dream a big dream, which is what my new book's about. I call it The Great Dream. I can dream that big dream, but it isn't just pie in the sky. It isn't just grandiosity. It's actually knowing the facts and the inclinations of the human race and knowing that we can do it. So before I go much further, I want to ask each of you, the audience as a whole, if there were 4 stages in the evolution of humanity, the human species, child, adolescent, young adult, and wise elder, I want to ask each people to put up their hands at each of those 4 stages and say, which one do you think the human race is at? So first of all, how many people think we're in the child stage? Okay. How many people think we're in the adolescent stage? Okay. How many people think we're in the young adult stage? And how many people think we're in the wise elder stage? And how many just don't put your hands up no matter what I ask? A lot of you, by the way. Well, as you saw, the majority of hands were in adolescent. I have done that all over the world. Not every time I speak, but a lot of times. Inevitably, the adolescents get the big hand raise, and it's usually about 90%. This time it was about, I'd say, 50 or 60% of the people that raised their hand. There are a whole lot of people that didn't. So it's not like we don't know that we aren't grown up, that we're not acting like adults. And while I was ready for this book to come out 2 years ago, I thought it should come out 2 years ago, it's finally come out last month as we are having conversations in the open media about why can't we have adult conversations in Washington and why can't we have adult conversations in lots of areas. So it's starting to get some traction, this idea that we're not playing like grown-ups. We're mature, our physical bodies are mature, but we're still acting out adolescence, a lot of us, a lot of the world. So, the title of tonight is Conscious Leadership, A Call for a New Paradigm. How many people here know what a paradigm is? Good. Thank you if you didn't know, for not putting up your hand. I remember sitting around in the 80s with a friend of mine from Stanford Business School named Michael Ray, who was kind of the king of the paradigms at Stanford. And we said, we can't use this word paradigm. It'll never play. It's too academic. It's too highbrow. It'll never catch on. And here it is 25 years later, and lots of people know what it means, or at least they think they know what it means. The kind of paradigm is like a mindset. It's a way of thinking about something. It's got traditions in it. It's got habits, habitual behavior in it. It's a worldview, another way of saying it. So you can have for instance, Steve Jobs changed the paradigm of personal computing. That's a paradigm change within an industry or within a technology. The paradigm I'm talking about is the worldview we have as a species. It's like it doesn't get much bigger in terms of a large context paradigm. We are steeped in a paradigm in the world of scarcity, fear, separateness, and what we could have by just simply shifting our consciousness is recognize our interconnectedness, that we are all connected, that we're not separate, that we're all related, and therefore there could be a love bond between us all rather than a fear bond, So those are big changes to make in a huge society, even a community, much less a society. So when I'm talking about paradigm change, I'm not talking about changing the form of something. I'm not talking about changing the color or the shape of something. I'm talking about a whole new gestalt for how we think about how we relate to one another and how we relate to the world. And that I know we can do. And it doesn't take congressional funding. It doesn't take learned people. It just means letting go of some old ways of thinking. What we could be facing is a collapse of our society as we know it. Now, a lot of people have been talking about collapse of various civilizations. We're talking about the collapse of Greece, possibly, maybe Italy. There's countries that are in crisis, economic crisis, but there's a lot of crises beyond just the economics. And Rebecca Costa, I'm not sure she's ever spoken here or not, but she may have, but she had a book out last year called The Watchman's Rattle. She's also a futurist. And she discovered two telltale signs of a society when it's about to collapse. One is when you hit gridlock. Well, do we have gridlock in our society? Yeah. The other one is when ideology starts replacing facts, when people start ignoring the facts and resorting to ideology. In the case of the Mayans, rather than dealing with the drought situation that they were in, and they were very good engineers around water and drought, they resorted to sacrifices and going back to pagan ways. Most of the societies, the old societies, have imploded. They haven't been conquered. They've basically fallen down by their own weight. In fact, every collapse that I can know of collapsed on its own, imploded. And we are in the process of imploding right now. I'm making that as an assertion. And I'm talking about the American empire and the American way of life. We cannot survive if everybody in the world started consuming and acting and behaving and thinking like Americans, we'd be extinct in two or three generations. The American way is not going to work for the rest of the world. But the rest of the world wants to do it the way we've been doing it. How are we going to resolve that? We're going to resolve that by creating a different future. Is it going to be Washington that does that? Is it going to be the UN that does that? Is it going to be our religious leaders that do that? I always see no. It's going to take all of us. And that's where the rubber meets the road. It's taking full responsibility, each of us, not them, each of us, me, changing the way we think, changing what we tolerate, changing the way we make the old legitimacy legitimate. So, last night I came here to the club because coincidentally there was a man speaking who is a historian at Stanford. And his name is Ian Morris. And just before my book went to press, does any people here know Stuart Brand and his meetings that he has at the Long Now Foundation? Every month he has these lectures. Incredible stuff. Well, one month, about 5 or 6 or 7 months ago, Ian Morris was one of his speakers. And I couldn't make it to it. And quite frankly, I wasn't really drawn to it. You know, Stanford historian talking about, what's the name of his book? How the West Rules for Now, I think it was. That's the name of his book. But a couple of years ago, Stuart started writing full summaries and sending them out the day after of the talk the night before. So if you didn't make it, you could, one, watch the video. But if you didn't want to watch the video, you could just read his email that Stuart composed. And in this email, I was glancing at it. I wasn't really reading it. And I saw this number or this sentence, and it just really got my attention. And I knew it had to be in the book. It had to be in this book. So I wrote an email to Ian, who I didn't know. I got his email off the Stanford website and asked him if he could confirm what Stuart had said. And Stuart was off a little bit, but he confirmed it in a nice email. So I got it into the book, the last thing I got in there. And basically what it was, and it's how he concluded his talk last night before the Q&A last night, that in the next 100 years, our society as a species is going to undergo 4 times more social development. That means that translates to 4 times more change than in the last 15,000 years. Is that sobering? The parenthesis is for better or for worse. So we have a choice. Oh, I just got goosebumps. Love it when that happens. The choice we have is to take responsibility and not just let it go, but take responsibility and turn it around. Big change is coming up. We're going to be going through some big, big changes right in the next few years. And we can make those changes for the better or for the worse. The other word in the title of this program is conscious leadership. So I thought I'd explain what I've been using that term for about 10 or 15 years in writing and doing some speaking about it. And what I mean by conscious leadership is not that our leaders become more conscious. That'd be great. But that each of us become a conscious leader. Everybody in this room is an expert at something out there in the world that needs changing. And my bet is you're not doing anything about it. You're watching it. You might be talking to friends why they don't change things, but you're not doing anything about it. We can't afford to do that anymore. We can't afford to sit back and be silent and condone dysfunctional behavior. We have to start taking responsibility when we see something that's wrong, of righting that wrong. The only way that human race is going to get through this and come into what a good friend of mine likes to call heaven on earth, because I actually do think it's possible that we could have everybody's needs, basic needs met. I'm not saying that we're a huge welfare state, but basic things like shelter, clean drinking water, that everybody and enough food to survive, no Cadillacs or Mercedes, but enough to get by, enough to have their basic needs met, so people aren't fearful of survival. The world will be a very, very different place. So what I'm calling for when I call for conscious leadership is for all of us to take responsibility for the whole, for all of us to take responsibility not only for our country or our community or our state, but for the whole planet. For me, the tipping point is going to be when we all start, well, not all, because we'll never have all, when a vast majority of us, I'll take that back, not even a vast majority, when many of us, I was out through 3 modifications in one sentence. When many of us start saying the common good is the priority rather than my particular wants and needs. And by that, I really mean our wants, because we confuse wants and needs a lot. Everybody in this room, I'm sure, is having their basic needs taken care of. So you don't need anything else. You may want something else. But if we can set aside our personal wants and personal egos, and what gives us gratification, and say, what's the best thing for the group, the whole, whether it's your community, your neighborhood, your country, the world. Excuse me. The other piece of conscious leadership is not only like to have awareness, to be aware, but to be responsible. So there's 2 pieces of that. The awareness, the consciousness that goes with growing up and becoming more conscious, but also being responsible for what you do. You can go to the top of a mountain and meditate and become, you know, really enlightened person, but if you're not dealing with what's going on in the world, it's not much value to the world. So the idea is to be aware and conscious and responsible for what you see. Most of us empower dysfunction, not because we're doing dysfunctional things, but because we're silent while other people do them and we don't say anything. 90% of the dysfunction is allowed, condoned through silence. I'm going to read you a piece. When you have a new book out, you just like to read stuff. This is about conscious leadership. Conscious leadership is a term I coined in the early 1990s to describe a state of mind that includes heightened awareness of what is needed for the whole and taking responsible action based upon that awareness. So you know what's going on and you're doing something about it, the combination of those two. As His Holiness the Dalai Lama has stated, as people see their predicament clearly, that our fates are inextricably tied together, that life is a mutually interdependent web of relations, then universal responsibility becomes the only sane choice for thinking people. The only sane choice for thinking people. One of the cases I make in the book is called The Great Growing Up. As might be implied by the title, I'm stating that we are in our adolescence as a species, and therefore we need to grow up if we're going to survive. One of the individuals that I took their writing as an indicator of adolescence, as a definition of adolescence, is a man who is a Jungian therapist. He actually headed up the Jungian Educational Center in Houston for 10 years. His name is James Hollis. He has written some. I saw a nod here. A few people may know about his work. He says, the characteristics of an adolescent culture are poor impulse control, short-term memory, all these sound familiar, ignorance of history, addiction to novelty and new sensations, sound familiar? Addiction to escalating intensity of sensation, like X Games maybe. Susceptibility to the lethargic summons of drugs and intoxicants. Mm-hmm. Susceptibility to the seduction of gurus, people in power and authority, and mostly flight from independence and responsibility. That's how he's describing an adolescent society. Other examples that he didn't mention, one that I've used a couple of times in the last couple of weeks, is the degree to which we gossip. And most of us don't think that we're gossiping, but we are. How much time, how much energy, how much consciousness do each of us put on what's going on, the latest scandal trial, the latest scandal in Washington, who's doing what to whom? And we not only spend time watching it in the media, then we spend more time having coffee with our friends and talking about it. And if you look at the amount of time that you put into conversations that have any real meaning in the world, not just that are tantalizing or a way of showing off that you know current events. That was one of the things about school, high school, that I remember about civics. You're supposed to know what's going on currently. And that may be where the meme got started there. But just knowing what's going on does not necessarily create a meaningful life for yourself. It just means that you know what's going on. You know how the jury's doing in this scandal case or what actress is doing this and all that sort of thing. It's amazing how much time. And I can tell, I don't engage in it, but I can look at the publications that are out there. I can go to the supermarket and see all the tabloids. Those tabloids would not be there if people weren't buying them. Those shows would not be on TV if people weren't watching them. So it's a great way to escape, to get into that stuff, but it is escapism. It's a form of addiction. One of the talks I gave last week, and somebody thought that I was saying we shouldn't be adolescent at all. We should never engage in adolescent anything. I want to clarify that that's not what I mean. I'm talking about the consciousness with which we bring to our behavior. We all have to play. We all got to play. We might even play like children sometimes. It's not like being an adolescent is bad. It's when it's unconscious, automatic, default that we do it. So we tend to think short-term, our organizations, short-term return, right, quarter to quarter. Years ago, I'm talking 15, 20 years ago, there was a big thing about learning from the Japanese, and they had 250-year business plans and all that sort of thing, and they had real minimum gaps between the highest paid and the lowest paid, and we ought to learn from them. Guess who learned from whom? The Japanese are more like American companies in terms of their income gaps inside their company, and they're doing short-term planning, not long-term planning anymore. Adults think long-term. They think of long-term consequences. They think about the whole. Adolescents think about tomorrow, what's in it for me, how can I get gratified as quick as possible, whether that's getting laid, getting a date for the prom, getting that car, whatever it happens to be. So I'm going to ask you each to break into pairs, otherwise known as dyads, and spend a couple of minutes sharing with one another ways in which I knew somebody would leave as soon as I suggested that. Some people go, oh, God, no. But find a partner. One, pick an A and a B, because the A will go first, I promise. And we'll take a couple of minutes each to share with the other person, in reflecting on your own life, ways in which you unwittingly, unknowingly, unconsciously engage in adolescent distraction, indulgence. Good. So find somebody to partner up with. One pick B and A and one B a B. Figure out who's going to be the A and who's going to be the B. You don't need to start yet. I just want to make sure everybody's paired up. Yeah, if you end up as a triad, so be it. Everybody paired up? You paired up? Okay. So you're paired up, everybody? Okay, so the first person, or in the case of three, the first two-thirds of the person, you start sharing whoever the A is. We'll have to figure out about how to get C's in here, but manage yourselves. This is, again, about individual responsibility. So I'm not going to even say break. Okay, now B's. I'm going to say take 10 minutes. That means when the arm goes to a little over 8 there. Take 10 minutes, and both of you share and work it out that it works out evenly. Okay? Look at your life and see how you... So you're talking about yourself, engage in adolescent behavior or tolerate adolescent behavior without necessarily even realizing you're doing it, because you came here and now you're hearing about it, you're starting to think about it, and you're going, oh, how about that, how about that, how about that? An example, I'll give you an example. Myself, I have an adolescent activity that I consciously engage in. I know I'm doing it. One of my first passions was motorsports. I loved auto racing. Built a race car, went to Bonneville, you know, all kinds of stuff. I still like to watch an auto race every once in a while. Now, most of my friends think that's really absurd. You know, you're doing all this work and the sustainability, and you're watching auto racing, and they burn all that gas. Yeah. I'm indulging my adolescent, but I'm doing it on purpose. It's a way of relaxing. It's like a couple of hours on a weekend, once in a while, not every weekend. But I know I'm doing it. So that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about getting sucked into conversations that don't go any, that have no meaning, that are perhaps gossip about, I was going to say Anna Nicole Smith, but she's long gone. But you know what I mean. You know, the current actress, the current scandal, the current sports celebrity thing, whatever it is, and how much time and effort and consciousness you put into those things without even thinking about it. But now you're thinking about it, so reveal them. Okay? So 10 minutes, and I'll give you a 1-minute warning.
Okay, thank you. I would like to remind our audience listening at home that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Conscious Leadership, Call for a New Paradigm with John Renish. I'm Kevin O'Malley, Chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum and your host for tonight. And now I'm going to turn it back over to John, and we'll be going into questions and answers.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Kevin. So imagine that that exercise generated some people that want to share, or questions, or comments, or challenges to what I've been saying. But do use the mic, because they are recording this for podcast or possible radio broadcast. Although that process that we just were involved in, obviously that's not going to work out too well on the radio, so they'll probably edit that out. But I have to say that I loved seeing the energy in the room. You guys really came alive, and it was really neat to see that. Anybody that did not get a chance to share, recognize that you had a responsible role in that thing about making sure you did, and if you didn't, then you can look at that yourself. So if anybody wants to share, there's the microphone here. Come on up and share, or ask, or challenge.
Interestingly enough, we concluded that the three of us were adults, because we don't get involved in, I don't have a television, Barbara doesn't have one, and we are, our tag is toward making the world a better place, and each of us is taking steps to do that. And we, none of us get involved with social trivia. I'm pleased to say that.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I definitely was not stating that we, none of us were adults. There's certainly adults in the world, and there's adult societies in the world. There are adult countries in the world, and there are also largely adolescent countries and people and so forth. It's the indulging of the adolescence to the degree that it's unconscious is that it's gotten, keeping us in a lot of trouble. Somebody else? Anyone else?
Good evening. I do have a few things I could share, but I actually wanted to ask you a question, see if I could draw you out or your thoughts on an issue. In this new paradigm, or well, not new, but newly discovered, I'm afraid, for many people, of personal responsibility, individual leadership on issues, how do you see the role of groups and groups who need to get a large number of people engaged to make some larger change? Because in the somewhat hyper-individualist paradigm that we have here with economies, with businesses, and also with very much the personal entrepreneurship that you so directly experienced, where do you see the role of the traditional term of leader, a leader of men, a leader of people, to organize around versus the cutoff of where individual responsibility is able to affect some of these necessary changes?
Okay, got it. Thank you. First of all, it's my experience is that you can't change anybody. Has anybody had the experience of trying to change somebody else? Have you been successful? The only person we have control over is ourselves. And a mutual friend of some of us in the room, Lynn Twist, writes about taking a stand as a very powerful place. When you take a stand for something, whether it's a new way of being or a new sense of ethic or whatever, and people see that, and a lot of people that are inclined that way but haven't evidenced that, might pick up on it and might lead, but you're not doing it to lead others. You're not doing it to manipulate them to get them to change. Because as soon as people start realizing you're trying to get them to change, what do? Resist. Now you've just been counter to what you said you wanted to do. So when I'm talking about individual responsibility, I'm talking about taking responsibility for our own lives. Many of the questions I get is, how do we get them to change? You know, like I'm enlightened, but how do I get my coworkers to change? How do I get my family to change? You know, whatever it is, you don't. You can do what you know and hold to your sense of conscious behavior and conscious thinking to a fault, and let other people be inspired by you. Allow them to be inspired by you. Now, when you're in a leadership position, a lot the Occupy Wall Street movement is an interesting one to look at because it's current right now. But there are people in those things, some of them, I don't know about all of them, but some of them are so completely self-organized that a movement, a bunch of pain or whatever, got people together and said, we got to do something, let's do it together, and who's going to do janitorial, who's going to do this, who's going to do that, and somehow it all got done. So that's self-organizing. That means surrendering some ego, being responsible for your part in the whole thing, and doing it. There's two reasons people change. One is because the pain is really great, and the prospects perhaps are that it's getting greater. The other reason people change is when there's an attraction to some sense of gain, pleasure, so forth. Almost all the change that happens in the world seems to happen from the former, not the latter. We seem to be motivated largely by running away from the pain and avoiding the pain. But we can also be attracted by a vision for a better world, and that's what I tend to write about mostly. Let's be attracted to something that is possible. Now, if you don't think it's possible, here's one of the big gets. If you don't think a better way is possible, you're going to do your damnedest to make the most of what you got here. Well, I don't think it's going to get any better, so I'm going to make my millions now. I'm going to screw everybody I can now. I'm going to get the most I can right now. That's what happened on Wall Street. I know it's all falling apart, but I'm going to get mine. And if it lasts another year, great, I made another $10 million, $30 million, $50 million. Is that some response to your question? Satisfying? Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Greg. Greg's a plant. He's a friend of mine.
Yeah, okay. Reed and I were talking about... I'm not interested in social gossip at all, but I do get my buttons pushed with following political changes in the country. And I have to go really to news sources outside of our U.S. media to find out a little bit more about what's under the surface. And I can get very angry about that and upset about it, but where do I take it from there? So it's kind of like I spend my wheels and spend a lot of time gossiping with others of like-minded, but really not doing much. And it's frustrating because I see changes. Well, you know, I have ties with Venezuela, and I'm interested. I think there's some great hope in countries and some things that are going on in South America right now. And I can see those changes, and I'm hopeful. But when you're talking about change here, I feel paralyzed because... You alluded to the empire imploding on itself, and I feel like, well, what can I do in all this? Any action that I take here, I think, is almost fruitless, and so where do I go from here? It's almost like I feel like I have to get out of this whole thing in order to be part of a positive change, and that's frustrating for me. So I don't know how really... You know, getting something concrete, making changes here in this whole capitalist, imperialist atmosphere that we're in, I think is very difficult. And I don't know quite how to go about doing that.
So. Okay. I've got something to say about that if you're complete. Are you complete? Great.
For now.
For now, yes. Yeah, I know you're not complete forever. One of the things, I don't have a flip chart or I'd show it in a flip chart, but a paradigm's life is like a sigmoid curve, as some of you may be familiar with. It gets started, its success may be kind of questionable, but it finally gets root and it takes off and people buy into it, and wow, off it goes. And then at some point, and this has been proven in life of corporations, life of societies, empires, if you want to call them that, in nature and just the way trees grow. It gets to a certain point, and its efficacy is challenged, and it starts to lose legitimacy. Our paradigm here in this world has been losing legitimacy for a long time. I can't say when, but I got involved because it was getting pretty apparent to me 25 or 30 years ago. A lot of people, and I'm talking about environmentalists and change agents and transformation consultants and all that, have been trying to keep this thing from crashing. So they're working, someday I'm going to have an illustration of this, but they're working their tails off to keep it from diving. So they're kind of extending this curve, flattening it out a little bit. And they're doing good work, but they're keeping the old paradigm alive. Now, meanwhile, there's a few of us, less of us, that have been perking along down here trying to get something going for a new paradigm, a new way of thinking. And it's just starting to get root, and people are starting to buy into it, but it isn't blossomed. It hasn't bloomed yet. So we have this old paradigm dying and this new one trying to get root and kind of stick its head out of the ground. And in this gap, it gets pretty scary. Everything I know and believed in all my life is kind of crashing, and that's what my values are based on, and I don't see anything to replace it, and I'm scared. So this cleavage, I like to call it just to be a little bit naughty, this cleavage between this curve going down and this curve coming up is where all the uncertainty and fear and chaos lives. And that's when people tend to grasp onto the old because they know that. So let's make it last a little bit longer. Let's recycle everything. Recycling's not going to get us out of this. We know that. It makes you feel better that you're recycling your plastic or your garbage and so forth, you're composting, whatever. You're off on a commune doing organic farming. Oh, great. But that's not the way the 7 billion people are, 7 billion and a few. That's not the way the world's working right now. So if there could be more people trying to birth something new through imagination, innovation, creativity, we could start creating a future that we want that's more suitable to now rather than what people wanted 300 years ago when we had a whole lot less people on the planet to deal with. So that would be my response. It wasn't, I know you didn't really ask a question, so I wasn't really answering a question, but my response is put your energy someplace where it's being creative, where it's generating, it's generative, rather than protective or motivated by fear, motivated by we got to keep the boat going, plugging the holes in the old ship, so to speak, rather than building a new ship. Okay? Jim, you want a microphone? You already talked.
So, John, so we were really creative in 2008. A bunch of us got together and saw a lot of change that might happen in the world. And I think we were looking at it from a positive perspective. And I think we were really excited about a painting that was being drawn by this amazing guy. And we got all excited. And we thought that we were going to change the world. And we descended on Grant Park by the billions. And it was really, really exciting. And then it went away. And here we sit now in on the cusp of another election cycle, and the positive things are not emerging. How do we get back to where we were in 2008, or do we?
Well, first of all, I don't think we'd get back to 2008. If we get back to something, it'd be something different than 2008. When I started a foundation some years ago, when I was going to do the robber baron model, I'm making money in real estate, now I'll start a foundation. That lasted about 6 weeks. But my foundation was going to promote systems thinking. If the good fairy godmother came down and said you can have one wish for the world, I would probably say that everybody knew how to think systemically and it was taught in the schools retroactively. Everybody already learned it. Because if we could think systemically, we'd realize that Jesus Christ or Muhammad could go into Washington as an elected, the president-elect, and they'd get their butt handed to them just like Obama did. That system is really dysfunctional. And unfortunately, just the way things are, we still have a society in this country that elects a superhero or somebody we think is a superhero, and then sits back and Monday morning quarterbacks them and, debriefs how we did, how you did in the third quarter and all that sort of thing. And Obama did say in his campaigning that it was going to take all of us. And I contend that most everybody went right back to business as usual. Let's see how he does. Meanwhile, what's going on with that celebrity trial? Meanwhile, what's going on over there? Did you see that latest movie? It was really great. About the Wall Street crash and all that. And meanwhile, Obama's in there trying to, in this, up to his knees in crap, I'll be polite, in this dysfunctional system. And I don't think he had a chance, given the system is so dysfunctional. Now, that said, some of the heat that he's getting is probably deserved. But I contend, I give the man the benefit of the doubt, that he's done the best he can considering the dysfunctional system that he's part of. What we can do is quit depending on the leader that we've designated and start taking responsibility for it ourselves. We have a lot of power, and most of it is being wasted through addictions, thinking, our the way we gossip, all that stuff is being wasted. If anybody hasn't read The Wisdom of Crowds, I highly recommend it. It's one of the best books I've written that impacted me, other than, of course, my own. But The Wisdom of Crowds shows how you can get a group of diverse people together, and inevitably you'll come up with wiser decisions than so-called panels of experts, that we all possess collectively great wisdom. And we could do rocket science with this group here. Even though some of us have rocket science background, many of us have other backgrounds. But together, one of the experiments they did, oops, I guess I better quit. I was going to tell a story. So come,
please tell
a story. There, this is back in the 18th century in a little village in England, and the state county fair had a contest. There was this, I don't forget, it was a cow or a pig. I think it was a cow. They had a cow and said, guess how much this cow will weigh when it's cleaned up and butchered and ready for market. And everybody got a vote on how much it weighed. They had not 1,000, but 900 people voted on how much this cow would weigh, dressed out. They were within 1 pound collectively, taking the whole total and dividing it by the number of people. They were within 1 pound of guessing the correct weight of that. That was in the foreword of the book. I still remember that story. So I'm going to read something at the end, but first we got to do a little...
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we just have time for some closing comments from John. I would like to let our audience listening at home know that our program tonight is Conscious Leadership, Call for a New Paradigm, and our speaker is John Renish.
Thank you, Kevin. And the club is selling books out front, and I will sign them if you want to buy one. I feel really privileged that so many of you turned out. More people came than actually signed up, which is nice to have happen. So, and thank you to all my friends who are here as well. In closing, I wanted to read one thing from the book. Two paragraphs. The world does not keep you separate. You keep yourself separate from the world. This is what made the world it is. The separated self is so ensconced in fear that the known fears of its existence seem preferable to the unknown fears of any other kind. That an option could be chosen that leaves no room for fear at all does not occur to it, for the absence of fear is something it has never known. And a philosopher named Peter Kingsley, who I happen to know, he says, it's only when we realize we are not separate at all that we start to become free. We are under a cosmic obligation to become conscious. We are under a cosmic obligation to become conscious. We are bound to do whatever we can to become more conscious. Even the longing to become free, to grow in awareness, to be more conscious, is predetermined by our inner nature, is our own divine self drawing us to itself. And to become one at last with that inner nature is to realize everything is bound by absolute laws. Then we are free, free from the illusion of having to choose, free simply to be ourselves. The separated self is the ego, or unfettered mind, godless self-will. This is how we separate ourselves from the rest of the world, perpetuating the myth that we are not connected as human beings. I thank you very much for your attention tonight.
Okay, I'd like to thank our speaker, John Renish, tonight for a great program. I also want to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club, our audience listening at home. And with this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is closed.